This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. From backroom statistician to corporate strategist, later in the show, we'll look at the changing role of accountants and financial professionals. First up this afternoon, over the last week, the stock market's been on a roller coaster ride, with the Dow Jones average gaining or dropping hundreds of points from one session to the next. Joining us to take a look at the recent market volatility and discuss ways to invest your money for growth are Michael Shore, Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer with Renaissance Investment Management, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimeo. Mike and Chris, good to see you this afternoon.
Great to be here,
Mr. Haney. Be here.
You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, are there some key numbers we should be keeping an eye on this week?
Well, it's more like a key word, which we'll all know within the hour or so.
Is it the secret word?
The secret
Maybe
word.
Maybe not so secret.
We need Groucho Marx. But yes, everyone's hanging on whether Fed Chairperson Yellen will say the word patient, if that will be part of the Fed statement, coming out at 2 o'clock. But we did get some numbers, and the numbers were a little less than expected. Industrial production and capacity utilization figures were below analyst expectations, and the housing starts released yesterday also came in much lower. But they're writing it off to the same set of excuses. They haven't even come up with new excuses. It's, well—
The weather?
The weather. Shock. I'm shocked. And then also, in addition to that, on the industrial production numbers, the weather was crummy, and they also had the strike on the West Coast with the ports.
Maybe they have a point there.
All sorts of things. But, you know, Mike, you look at these kinds of numbers all the time. Is there any one set of data points that will cause you as a professional money manager to jump in or jump out, or is it just the whole parade of them?
No, I think it really is a whole mosaic of all the statistics is what you need to be focused on. Any one statistic, there are so many statistical outliers in some of this data, and you notice some of the weather and the strike in the West Coast and so forth that will skew some of the data. But particularly in a time like this where people are focused on interest rates and the Fed decision today, any one data point can really lead you astray, I think, in terms of an investment outlook.
Well, especially if you are in equities at these days, and as Mark mentioned earlier, the volatility has been just extraordinary. You know, up 200, down 300, up 100. It's we've had so many triple digit moves that we should be sending out neck braces with statements. The market as we speak right now, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 123 points. But think back to where we were a year ago when the new Fed chairperson Yellen had her first, press conference, because this is sort of a newer thing to make the announcement and then have a press conference. And the market was higher. The initial reaction was up at 2 o'clock. And then she started talking, and no one knew how to translate what she was trying to get apart. And by the time she was done, the market was down 150, 200 points. Are the people getting accustomed to this now? And how much more important is the press conference after the release and the actual release itself?
I think the interpretation of remarks sometimes takes a while, and I think you need to hear how the talking heads in the news kind of interpret whatever they just heard from the press conference. And then there's investor reaction to that, too, which becomes kind of a self-feeding kind of frenzy sometimes.
Yeah. The volatility, though, right after that 2 o'clock, it has been pretty spectacular.
So what's the story behind the word patient? I guess the thought is that the patient is not going to appear in the statement, which means that what?
Let me get my decoder ring here. If the word patient, if the Fed will be patient, that means that they're more likely to refrain from raising rate. If the word disappears, it means that they see the economy being a little stronger.
And they will be more likely to raise rates.
To raise rates sooner rather than later.
Correct.
But, patience is kissing cousin is the hyphenated data dependent. They remain data dependent, which means we could always change our mind. So it depends on how these numbers come out, whether the underlying trend of the economy really warrants finally raising rates off the mat.
When was the last time the Fed raised interest rates, though? It's been a number of years, hasn't it?
Well, many moons.
Many, many moons prior to the financial crisis. We've been in a zero interest rate environment since 2008, essentially, early 2009. And not just zero interest rate policy in terms of short-term rates, but the quantitative easing program, which intended to drive down long rates as well. So it really has been an extended period of time for low interest rates, which is part of the reason why there's so much focus today. This would be the first time in many, many years that you saw a rise in Fed policy.
Yeah, and Mike, at Renaissance here in Cincinnati, you have made a name for yourselves as growth investors. What exactly is growth investing, and how does it differ from value investing?
Well, I wouldn't say that we disregard value, but we are first and foremost focused on identifying companies that show growth rates in earnings and revenues and earnings stronger than that of the typical company and greatly in excess of the growth rate in the economy as a whole. So our first focus is trying to find companies where either through new products, new distribution channels, new market opportunities, there's an ability to see some good top line and bottom line growth. And then secondarily, focus on trying to identify companies that are selling at reasonable valuations that have that characteristic of strong growth. In terms of a value manager, we're not a value manager, so I could be somewhat prejudiced in this, but typically a value manager doesn't care so much for the growth. They're just very, very cognizant of how much they're paying for the company's shares. And growth may or may not be an element in their decision.
Okay, thank you.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. You can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Robert in Kenwood. Good afternoon, Robert. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, thank you. I have a son who's come back on spring break from college, and he's trying to convince with other students the corporation to divest from companies that do business with fossil fuels. And I know that Stanford has done that, and locally University of Dayton, as well as the Rockefeller Foundation. Is there any movement in the among investors to move away from corporations that are fossil fuel, and might that pick up in the future because of the possibility of climate change? And also, are there any index funds? I invest in index funds mostly. Any funds that have low expense ratios that would accommodate a green portfolio?
Quickly, we really have to shy away from mentioning specific securities on the show, but Robert, there are socially responsible funds that are index funds, and you can just go to the Morningstar website and run a screen. Those are pretty easy to find. There are exchange-traded funds, and there are index funds which do that. But to the point about the fossil fuel companies, if you look at what's been happening to the share prices of the big ones, the big multinational energy companies, it's been a real brutal market for them anyway, and there has been some institutional shying away of them. Michael, does that kind of thing influence you as a growth investor, whether there is if you're doing your fundamental research on a growth story, if you know, there's some kind of stigma attached to it from a socially responsible angle?
I would say, you know, at the margin, but at a very distant margin. I think our challenge as institutional investors is to seek the highest return for our clients. And at times, that may include a company that's involved in the fossil fuel industry if the price support is attractive and the market opportunities are attractive. We'll take advantage of that. We do accept direction from clients, and in some cases, endowments are probably the most likely ones to have this kind of a restriction. They may hire us with a restriction of do not invest in the fossil fuel mm-hmm. area, and we do have some assets in that category.
Sure.
Chris or Mike, do either of you see a trend in funds or individuals investing more with what is known as socially conscious investing funds?
Yeah, that's kind of what we're talking about. We do see more of a trend. I wouldn't say it's a huge number. But again, we take direction from clients, not just on fossil fuels, but also in various social policy companies that manufacture abortive fashions or certain kinds of drugs and so forth, to exclude those from the portfolio at the direction of the client.
Yeah.
And so we are seeing definitely more of a trend there. I wouldn't say it's huge, not in our business at least, but in some firms really specialize in that area.
Yes. On the flip side of that, what about people? What about demand for green energy funds? Do you see that going up?
It is going up. Again, it's not something that
we do.
And it's easier for us to exclude a category as opposed to focus on another category and just find opportunities within a narrow subset like green energy.
Yeah, and there are several. Again, just by Googling, you can Google green energy exchange-traded funds or green energy closed-end funds. There are many of them. Think of the energy complex, though. A few years ago, solar companies were very tiny, and and they didn't have earnings, and they didn't have a lot of sponsorship. Everyone thought probably a good idea, but years from being profitable. And now, thanks to technology and the nanotechnology and all the advances, suddenly these solar companies are doing quite well. If you're looking at the energy sector, how do you make a determination whether to be with a traditional multinational integrated oil company that does exploration, drilling, refining, the whole bit, or should you be looking at perhaps an alternative energy company?
Well, just to follow on your point there, some of the alternative energy companies have done reasonably well, but with the price of oil down 50% over the last 6 or 7 months, that is their competition. So you can't look at some of the sustainable energy companies in isolation. They are competing against fossil fuel manufacturers and discovering fossil fuels. And so with oil at these prices, it does make some of the alternative energy pretty uneconomical.
It's a headwind.
Yeah.
Mike, and this one always confuses me. Oil prices, you're talking about how they're really, really low right now. We probably haven't seen prices this low in, I'd say, a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. Why is this? You know, I'd look at this as good news, but yet the markets react to it adversely. Why is that?
Well, it's certainly good news for consumers of energy. So you see airline stocks have done particularly well over the last 6 months as oil prices have come down. You're seeing, we believe, the early stages of benefits to consumers, just you and I, in terms of lower gasoline prices, lower costs, and so forth. But for the energy complex, clearly it's bad news. And so for some areas of the country, like Texas, for example, which has been one of the leading states in terms of job creation over the last 4 or 5 years, suddenly they're seeing kind of a reversal of that positive trend. And then, not that this is significant in a national sense, but if you're in North Dakota and you've been benefiting from the fracking boom over the last couple of years, it's kind of a disaster as they've built out all these hotels and places for temporary workers to live.
Man camps.
Man camps. And now there's no demand for them. So there's that. There's also the fact that anytime you see a sudden drop in a commodity like this, it does create some possible instabilities within the economic system. And, you know, some of the higher yield bonds that have been issued over the last couple of years have come from energy companies. And it might be that retirees are invested in some of these higher yield bonds and don't realize that some of these bonds are becoming less creditworthy as oil prices have declined. So there might be some instability resulting from that.
Good point. And Mike, at your website, there'll be a link to your website from the WVXU.org website. But you post monthly, month-end commentary. You have quarterly commentaries, even white papers on volatility. And what really kind of really strikes me is in what kind of environment then, and in a volatile environment, where can investors looking for growth names be more likely to find it? Which sectors of the market are likely to yield some of these, be the happy hunting ground, so to speak, of growth names?
Yeah, well, again, we can't name individual companies, but in terms of sectors, it's interesting. Post 2008 and early 2009, where the financial system pretty much came apart, everybody wanted stability. Everybody wanted yield. And to a certain extent, they still want that today, right?
The consumer staples names.
Consumer staples names, utility stocks, and so forth. So utility stocks, just to pick on them, have traditionally traded at a discount to the market in terms of price earnings multiples because their growth characteristics are not really that high.
Yeah, they're paying out so much of their earnings as a dividend.
Correct. Today, though, they're selling at a premium to the market. And so I think it's just a reflection of the fact of how attractive yield is. Conversely, technology companies typically trade at a premium to the market because they do have strong growth characteristics. And today, they're selling at or around the market multiple. So there's a sector that I would suggest has a lot of potential going forward.
We'll continue our conversation with Chris DeSimeo and Michael Schroer, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guests this afternoon are Michael Schroer, Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer with Renaissance Investment Management, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimeo, as we talk about why the market's been so skittish lately and look at ways to invest your money for growth. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mike, this is another one that always confuses me, too. The strength of the dollar. The dollar's doing pretty well. Again, it's one of those things that seems like it should be good news, but the strong dollar is causing a lot of this bumpiness, isn't it?
That's true. And a strong dollar, I think, is reflective of the fact that most of the world is reducing interest rates. We're talking about potentially increasing interest rates here. Of course, higher rates here make the dollar a little bit stronger, a little bit more attractive to foreign investors, which is what's driving that price up. The negative side of that is that companies, American companies, actually export quite a bit. And a typical company in the S&P 500 index is pretty close to about 40% of revenues coming from overseas economies. And so a stronger dollar makes our products a little bit less competitive overseas, whether you're selling into Asia or to Europe. So the net result of that stronger dollar is maybe a little bit lower profits for a Procter & Gamble, or even a General Motors, which sells a lot of cars in overseas as well. So that's the perceived negative behind a stronger dollar, is perhaps lower corporate profits for big multinational U.S. companies.
Chris, if the Fed does raise interest rates, I mean, they're practically zero right now anyhow. What's the thought of where they go to? You know, is it like 0.25% maybe, or do we even have any idea? Mike, do we know?
My thought, and we'll be all proven wrong here shortly probably, but but I think that it will be a nominal increase at some point.
A series of baby steps.
It really have to be. You know, normally interest rates are, in terms of long-term bond yields, are some level above the rate of inflation, 2 to 3%, which implies a long-term bond yield of around 4 or 5%. Nobody sees that coming in the near term here. So I think there'll be a series of baby steps on the short term interest rates to kind of raise them slowly and ultimately see a little bit higher bond yields too.
You know, what's behind this trend, Michael, that we've seen where some of the names in the technology sector, for example, are growing their earnings? They're showing up a lot of growth radar screens. And they buy a company, and it used to be when you had a takeover announced, it would be the shares of the target going up and the shares of the buyer going down. We've had a few lately where just the opposite has happened, where the shares of the company making the purchase actually start going up. Is this a trend that you see continuing, and what's behind that kind of behavior?
I think it's hard to break down a general statement there. I do think that there are cases where some of these fast-growing technology companies can leapfrog their growth by making a strategic acquisition, where they buy something that maybe in terms of dollars and cents, doesn't look extraordinary, but in terms of a new product or a new distribution channel or something along those lines, it creates a jump in terms of future corporate profitability that maybe is not, in an accounting sense, recognized today, but from an investor perception standpoint is recognized today, and that accounts for that jump in the acquiring company.
Yeah, we've seen that. I mean, it used to just happen infrequently, and lately, though, it's happening in the technology sector and the healthcare sector and even in the biotechnology sector. And so are you seeing this where instead of just saying, well, we're in the pharmaceuticals, you have to kind of break it down between, you know, big cap pharma and biotech? Or is that the kind of slicing and dicing that growth investors should be looking to do in 2015?
Yeah, I think that having some discrimination in terms of the healthcare names that you invest within the healthcare portion of your portfolio is important. You know, for us, what we're all really focused on identifying are companies with a strong degree of earnings momentum, which implies companies where earnings forecasts are being revised upward, as well as reasonable valuation. Some of the biotech names, if you recall, early in 2014 reached fairly high valuation levels.
Only to get crushed.
And then they got crushed. And we're getting to the point now where some biotech names are reaching some of those levels as well. So you have to be careful about what you're paying for also.
Chris, I'd like to come back to the idea of what happens if interest rates should go up. What does that mean for the average person in terms of, you know, buying a car, buying a boat? Is it going to be a big impact?
Well, if you've been waiting, if you haven't refinanced yet a couple times, you should be thinking about doing that. If you haven't you know, again, if you look at your high interest rate credit card debt, you really should be looking to pay that off. If you come into some money through an inheritance or a bonus, you should really be paying that off because there is a lot of debt out there that's high interest rate. But if you have the opportunity, you should really be looking ahead and figuring out any way you can to lock in lower interest rates for a longer period of time in your own on your own balance sheet. It's really important to manage both sides of the balance sheet. There are some very large companies, and this is not to make an investment recommendation, but there are some very large companies who do not need to borrow money. Companies that have vast amounts, oceans of cash, that went into the bond market and borrowed money at 1.5-2% for long periods of time.
Because they needed, it was so cheap.
Not because they needed the money, but because it made sense to do it because if they could, if their cost of funds is 1.5 and 2 and their earnings growth, their return on their equity is much higher than that, then they're just amplifying. They're leveraging that. When, you know, Michael, when you look at a company, do you are there certain indicators that cause a company to show up on a growth screen? In other words, you have to look at a lot of different indicators, like how much debt do they have? Have they done a smart job managing the balance sheet? Are there certain indicators that an average investor could use to say, aha, there's something going on here?
Yeah, again, I think there's a mosaic rather than any particular one factor that we look at. But broadly speaking, they would fall into, I think, three categories. Growth measures, which look at things like historical returns on invested capital that a company's been able to achieve.
So-called return on equity, that's something
that's one of those components.
Easily available.
Cash flow usage, so are they using cash to repurchase shares or reduce debt, or are they seeing their cash be generated by issuing debt and so forth? So that's another measure. But those are growth-related measures. We also look for momentum, as I mentioned earlier, which is just whether earnings forecasts are being revised upward or downward. And basically, that's as much to keep us out of companies or earnings forecasts are being trimmed dramatically as finding the ones that are showing positive growth.
Yeah, that's something that the folks at Zacks Research out of Chicago have long advocated, is to look at the trend of analysts revising earnings forward, you know, upward versus downward.
Should everybody be using a growth strategy or have some amount of growth in their portfolios or like a percentage that they should be shooting for?
Well, you know, it depends on the index provider, but typically indices like the S&P 500 are broken down by S&P into growth and value indices that are roughly half between growth and value.
Russell does that as well.
Russell does that as well, another index provider. So if an investor is all value, they're basically leaving half the marketplace out of consideration for their portfolio. And if you're all value too, in today's market, what that means is you have a pretty high energy exposure, you have a pretty high financial exposure. Not that those things are necessarily terrible things in the very long term, although energy, you might argue, might be a little bit tough to stomach over the next couple of months. Growth, including a growth portion of your portfolio, gives you a complete coverage within the market for opportunities.
Is it riskier to take the growth route?
Typically, growth companies have a little bit more volatility associated with their shares, and that's due to the fact that their returns depend a lot on what's happening in the future earnings growth. And so things can go wrong with a growth company as well. So the shares tend to be a little bit more volatile. A higher beta is what we call in the industry. You can control for that. And we feel that we control for that by having a lower price earnings bias to our portfolio. So we don't pay up for growth companies. But if you just buy the fastest growing companies out there, yes, it would be a very volatile ride for you.
Okay, so the best way to do it is what you were talking about earlier, where you take maybe a 50-50 approach if you're doing all stocks and do part growth, part value. And
yeah, diversification, okay. Diversification is kind of the magic formula in this business. If you diversify, you can handle a lot of what we're talking about in terms of short-term volatility.
Fascinating stuff it is. And, you know, it is interesting to watch. Some of these names have actually done quite well. There are certain names in media that have done shockingly well so far this year, certain names in technology. But it's been a tough market, broadly speaking. So you have energy that's lower. You have some media companies are a lot higher. In general, though, it's been a wash so far. It's just been an amazing year.
So, Chris, you think the volatility continues?
I think we're all shaking our heads.
Just kind of
yes.
a fact of life?
Just stay tuned another 28 minutes, and after the Fed announcement, just watch.
Well, you know, I always take a look at the volatility index, that VIX number.
The VIX.
Right,
yes.
Which is kind of like measuring the market's blood pressure. You know, high is bad, low is good. And it was around 1551 this morning. And it's been as high as 31 in the past 52 weeks. So that 1551's really pretty good. So why all these big swings? I mean, what? It's just.
Well, you know, I think you can sometimes you can get faked out by looking at the point swings, and this is a very obvious point. But hundreds of points in the Dow is not that much in terms of percentages.
It's not what it used to be.
Not
10
what
years
it used
ago.
To be. As Chris and I remember the old days where 100 points was incredible. But if you look at the VIX index, I mean, to your point, VIX index back in 2008, 2009 was above 60. Actually, hit 70.
Ouch.
Some levels.
Yes.
So even 31, as high as it got over the last year or so, it was twice as high during the worst periods of the financial crisis. So if you look at a longer-term trend line of the VIX index, which again is statistically derived as opposed to anecdotally derived, it really hasn't been that volatile outside of particular little spikes. It's more of a normal market environment.
And Mike, just because the Dow's bouncing up and down so much, that doesn't mean the entire market is also going up and down.
The whole market is bouncing up and down. Correct. The broader market's a little bit more stable.
Yeah, keep in mind that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is just 30 companies, and some of these companies' shares are trading in triple digits. And because of the way it is constructed, a 1% move on a stock trading in triple digits is going to have a lot more impact on that index than it would be with an index that's weighted by the size of the company, a capitalization-weighted index such as the S&P 500.
Right. The Dow is price-weighted, so it's not really it just was a creature of convention, I guess, in the business.
1896,
the Dow, right?
I think.
But there really is not a whole lot of reason to focus on that right now.
Yeah. Speaking of price-weighting and growth stocks, is Apple going to get into the Dow? I've been hearing rumblings
Apple's
about that.
Apple's going into the Dow, yeah. And, of course, if Apple was in the Dow 10 years ago, we would be,
the Dow would be a lot higher.
Yeah, a lot higher. I'm not sure what that number would be, but it would be a lot higher, right?
Yeah. Well, can you give some final advice for people thinking about, I haven't really been doing much with a growth strategy. What are some first steps they can take to start taking on that strategy?
Well, I think you first of all need to look at your portfolio and see if you have any exposure to growth stocks in your portfolio right now, either through a growth manager, a growth fund, an index fund, what have you. So you get a feel for where you are today. And then if you are short on the growth side, and by short I mean something well below a 50% type level, then you ought to identify ways to approach that. You could do that through the use of a mutual fund, a manager that manages growth stocks in a diversified way. If you feel confident, you can pick your own growth stocks, but I would suggest that most people probably ought to shy away from that.
Well, Mike and Chris, thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure.
Michael Schwer is Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer with Renaissance Investment Management, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimeo.